From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. The New York Times releases a new index that ranks 100 elite and selective colleges on access for low-income students. And the Education Advisory Board suggests that the best return on investment for campus retention efforts might be to focus on students in what it calls the murky middle, those students who have a freshman GPA of 2.0 to 3.0. Hi, this is Casey Green. I'm the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. Welcome all. Ahead of our conversation, please note you can post your thoughts about these conversations on the comments section of the This Week page, insidehighered.com/thisweek. In our first segment, we will discuss ranking elite colleges on access. Concurrent with what has now become its annual fall higher education conference, on Monday evening, the New York Times unveiled a new higher education index focused on access to elite and expensive colleges by low-income students. The Times have been signaling the index announcement with a series of articles ahead of the release of the index, taking elite colleges to task for not enrolling more low-income students. The index, which listed 100 colleges and only three public institutions, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, the College of William & Mary, and the University of Virginia, drew on data highlighting FTE endowment resources, the percentage of students who receive Pell Grants, and the net cost for students whose families earn between $30,000 and $48,000. Topping the Times Index was Vassar College, where about a quarter of the students receive Pell Grants, where the FTE endowment is $340,000 per student, and where the net cost for enrollment for low-middle-income students is just $5,400. Harvard, with a net cost of $3,000, but where just 17% of undergraduates receive Pell Grants, ranks 6th, behind Grinnell College, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, Smith, and Amherst. As with any index or ranking scheme, the Times offering was not without controversy. Focused on selective or elite institutions that had four-year freshman graduation rates of 75% or higher, the methodology immediately eliminated many public institutions as contenders, even as these institutions, both elite and less selective, may have 5 or 6 year graduation rates at or above 70 or 75%. Joining us for this conversation are Catherine Bond Hill, known as Cappy Hill, who is the president of Vassar College, Bernie Matchin, who is the president of the University of Florida, and Scott Jasek, co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Scott, let me turn to you. You have seen these ranking schemes from U.S. News and other sources. It's ranking seasons. Does the Times Index of the most economically diverse colleges really provide any new information or insight? Is there anything actionable here if I'm a college president or a board chair?
Well, I think it definitely shows that among that elite group, not everyone is doing as well at recruiting and retaining low-income students. The reality is there are a lot of colleges on that list that should have higher percentages of Pell recipients, should be doing more. And I think it's great to highlight that. The question for society, though, is that if you want to get more low-income students on a mass level into higher education, these institutions aren't going to solve that problem. They just don't have enough space. And so the criticism that I hear is that it shifts attention away from issues like the funding of public higher education, the provision of need-based aid, at those things for students going to non-elite colleges that are more likely to make a difference. But, you know, great for Vassar and not so great for other colleges that are low on that list.
Well, Cappy Hill, let's turn to Vassar. You were number one on the list, and the Times highlighted the fact that you've almost doubled the percentage of students with Pell Grants, rising to 23% from 12% from 2008, a modest cost of $5,400 for low-middle-income families. This suggests a real change at Vassar in the last several years. How did you do it, and what might others learn from your experience?
Well, we had taken a look at the diversity of our student body in 2006 and decided that it wasn't as diverse as we would like it in a variety of ways. So we returned to being need-blind in the admissions process and really went out looking for a more socioeconomically diverse pool of students. And then, of course, the financial crisis hit in 2008. And so even families that we would have been taking in the past, their financial need went up. So we had to look at what we were spending our resources on and figure out a way to make sure that we had enough to support the financial aid needs of our students, and we were able to do that. We did it partly right after the recession by taking a little bit more out of the endowment, and it's sustainable in the long run, but we've gotten that use down. And then we looked at other spending and figured out that there were some things that we could pull back on to protect financial aid while also protecting the curriculum.
There's been some criticism about Vassar that some of the pullback that you allude to, Cappy, was faculty salaries and some other educational resources. Is that a fair criticism?
No, it's actually not at all. I think it came from a sentence in the New York Times article. What we did do, so if you look at our faculty salaries, we've had very competitive percentage increases, and we compare our faculty salaries for assistants, associates, and fulls with a group of 20 other national liberal arts colleges, and we're above the mean across all ranks. What we did do was, in 2005 and 2006, when markets were very strong, we had had some significant increase in staffing, both on the faculty and the non-faculty side. And in response to the financial crisis, we decided that we could pull back on our staffing levels while maintaining competitive compensation.
Great.
So we have not, we have felt very much our curriculum is about the size that it was in 2006 when we thought it was quite strong. So I think we've protected our academic quality.
Bernie Machen, president of the University of Florida, you're the source of a widely tweeted quote that suggested the Times ought to get real with its methodology and that the index needs to be based on either 5 or 6 year graduation rates or the 75% threshold is just not realistic in terms of many institutions that serve low-income students. Was the index stacked against public institutions like yours?
No, I like the index and the attention it focuses on socioeconomic issues. What I point out is that if you're talking about the whole breadth of higher education, you've got to get below a four-year graduation rate of 75%, and you'll find there's a whole other set of schools that are working really hard on the same issue, but they're not showing up in the Times report.
Well, so what would be an appropriate threshold then if it's not 75%? Is it the 5-6 year graduation rate? Is it a 70% number?
Well, I mean, I think you all can, I mean, you can play with that as you run the data. For example, we have a 65% four-year graduation rate and an 87% six-year graduation rate, which puts us in the upper tier of public institutions. The other thing is you got to look at the, if you really want to impact the issue of getting more low socioeconomic students into higher ed, you have to look at the volume issue. We have 29% Pell Grants right now. That translates into over 10,000 students, okay? So that's the kind of impact that I think the Times Index, while making its point, doesn't fully get the value that it could get if it looked at the numbers a little differently.
So Scott Jasek at Inside Higher Ed, what about the methodology and these thresholds that would seem to preclude others that would certainly be are certainly reaching out to low-income students and have comparatively high retention rates?
Absolutely. I mean, one person that I quoted suggested that they should have started rather than with a 75% four-year rate, but what if they had started with 20% Pell-eligible students? Vassar still gets in and looks good for its student body, but a bunch of others on that list wouldn't be eligible. And the other important thing to remember is that at institutions that are less competitive than the University of Florida, at institutions where half the students are Pell eligible, the places that are serving students like that are serving students for whom life happens and they are in and out of higher education. And it's not to say that those institutions don't deserve scrutiny on graduation rates. They do. But they are never going to have the graduation rates of Vassar or Florida, for that matter, because of the high percentage of very low-income students they serve. So to use that as a, this is who is worth looking at, I think upsets people. The other really important point is I think some of the reaction to this is because of the impending Obama administration ratings. People are very nervous right now about who's going to get compared to whom, and this is an example of the kind of comparison that people worry about.
Cappy Hill, at Vassar, I want to come back to something you said a few moments ago, though, and that's the whole issue of need-blind admissions. There was a time, and it may seem like a mythical long time ago, that most public and private nonprofit institutions really did engage in need-blind admissions for their students. Your comments suggest that Vassar and certainly others had moved away from that for a while. Can you talk about the issue of need-blind admissions and how that seems to have ebbed and flowed as a matter of institutional policy and potentially even public policy?
Yeah, I mean, I think need-blind is it's a slightly ambiguous term because you could be need-blind in the admissions process, but if you only sent your recruiters to Scarsdale and fairly well-off suburbs of big cities and independent schools, you wouldn't end up with very many low-income kids in your pool. So I don't think need-blind is all the end of everything and a real goal. But I think it's the commitment to recruiting lower-income students, however you do it. Need-blind, I find appealing just because it does say that when we look at applicants, we're not going to take their need into account. Not all schools are in a position to afford that. But I think it also helps get lower-income students into the pool because students realize that they're not going to be either turned down or not given adequate financial aid because of their need.
Bernie Matchin at Florida, but the flip side of need-blind seems to be this rising movement towards merit, either as a matter of institutional policy or in some cases state mandate in terms of where that money can be spent and on whom the money can be spent. Does this work against efforts in terms of improving access opportunities for low- and middle-income students?
It certainly does. I think that is the dilemma that the publics are faced with. Many state legislatures have been focusing on merit-based aid, which is okay, but they are ignoring the huge unmet need that's out there from need-based side. And I think we need a sort of a public outcry to get more need-based aid. And let's not let the federal government off here as well. I think we need to do much more with Pell Grants to make them much more functional and much more useful in helping the need-based students.
Scott, comment about the issue of merit aid?
Sure. I actually try not to use the term merit aid, but prefer non-need-based aid, because what a lot of colleges are doing is using non-need-based aid to basically lure students from one college to another. We don't think you'll pay X thousand to enroll here, but we'll give you this money that you don't need to do so. And what that gets at is the huge sums of money that are being spent on students who don't need it, while others do. And being need-blind in admissions, while Cappy's absolutely right that you could be need-blind and not recruiting, if those institutions that are abandoning need-blind are saying for the last 10% of our class or whatever, the wealthy get in. People don't like to talk about it that way, but that's the choice they're making. And so I think more scrutiny for choices is really important right now.
Cappy and Bernie Matchin, let me come back to the issue of where you go. Cappy, you alluded to this in terms of going to just where the recruiters might go in terms of middle or upper income suburbs. It's an issue in terms of the states, in terms of urban and rural schools. We see this in many public institutions as the numbers of students from out of state come in to increase the revenue. You know, how does all this begin to, again, play with the issue of access for low- and middle-income students? Bernie Matchin, let me begin with you.
That's a great question, and the interaction there is multifaceted. Many public schools, not in Florida, are recruiting out-of-state students under the so-called banner of diversity, but it's really the sub-banner of economic support for the institution. I think that when you are a public and you're committed to helping the entire population, then you need to be very sure that you're recruiting in all the various parts of the state. One of the things I found out was that many young people who had the academic credentials to get in the University of Florida weren't coming here because they didn't have the financial resources to go there. So we've been trying hard to get the word out. Keep applying, and we'll work with you on getting you the need-based aid you need so that you can come to the University of Florida. It's a huge problem that requires everybody to, number one, to bring it out into the open, and then number two, let's go after it.
And Kathy Hill, to your point, how did recruitment change at Vassar in terms of your reference to going to city or rural schools as opposed to middle and upper income suburbs?
I think there's lots of evidence out there that there are plenty of talented low-income students, and you just have to reach them. So we did a variety of things in terms of admissions officers going to different places, partnering with organizations that also help locate talented low-income students to send them to our kinds of schools. So it's very easy to do. I'd just like to add, you know, if we're going to attack this issue of low-income access, we have to do it right across the spectrum of American higher education. I think the New York Times Index helps in that it's asking the nonprofits to do their bit, but I also agree that we're not going to address this unless we address the publics, the four-year publics and the two-year community colleges. And it either has to be a combination of more resources for higher education or reallocating the resources that we're currently spending. And we just need to address it.
Let me turn to another aspect of this issue, though, and which is not just money. I mean, we've had since almost, 1965 with the Higher Education Act, the efforts of elites in one way or another to reach out to bring in low-income students, minority students. And we know that it's not just a matter of money, but it's also a matter of a set of support services and infrastructure for students who may not have been as advantaged in terms of academic resources and their secondary school experiences. Bernie Matchin at Florida, what are the infrastructure issues there for students?
You know, you would think that these low-income students have issues, but remember, they have to meet the same academic bar that any student meets to get in. What we have found, and it's not unlike the Posse program, that we provide them support in other areas, like social support. We give every one of our low-income admitted students an academic mentor, but also a personal social mentor, and also a student mentor. Many of them don't understand things like going to restaurants and having the opportunity to participate in various activities that middle-class kids grow up with. So the kind of support might surprise you when they reach out to us and say, can we have a table etiquette course as part of our orientation? We do provide that to these students on a as-they-want-it basis.
And Kathy Hill, again, the issue of infrastructure and support for these students, it's not just a matter of money?
Well, I think one of the reasons that it seems fair that these talented low-income students should have access to these selective nonprofits is because they are spending the most per student, and in fact, that spending does translate into some of these support services. That's partly why our graduation rates are so high. We have lots of services in addition to the academic curriculum that make it much more likely that you're actually going to get through in 4 or 5 years. So those talented low-income students are better served if they can, in fact, go to the more selective schools with the services.
And, Scott, you've seen a lot of campuses that have reached out, not just in terms of aid, but also services. What can you add to this conversation?
Well, one, and this is why it's important that Vassar does have so many low-income students, a critical mass matters. Students care that they're not the only one in whatever situation they are in, and students are very aware if they feel they're in an environment where everyone else is a country club person. But then you have very practical issues like the ability to take an unpaid internship. That may be great for a wealthy student, may not be viable for a low-income student. So some colleges are helping that. Issues like study abroad, which is a key experience for many students. Does the financial aid follow? Is there help navigating that? Which, for a student who may be wealthier, may have been abroad a dozen times, for a low-income student, that may be a significantly new experience. So colleges that care about this are thinking holistically and not just letting the student in, but looking at the full experience.
Let me give the two presidents a last comment. So speaking to your peers, Kathy Hill and Bernie Matchin, the two or three most important things that you would suggest to your colleagues, other presidents, for their institutions that really are determined to increase the proportion of low-income students at their institutions. Cappy Hill, let me begin with you.
I guess I would say the best solution to this is going to be if we face incentives, both from things like the rankings, but also from the federal government, to do more on low-income access. It's very difficult for each of us to individually do it. So I'm actually supportive of the New York Times Index, and I actually hope that the federal government comes out with something that creates incentives for our sector to do more.
And Bernie Matchin, counsel to your peer presidents?
Well, I also support the New York Times Index, like Kathy, but for my schools, it's important that we recognize that true diversity includes socioeconomic diversity as well, and it ought to be looked at, and frankly, it ought to be counted. So having it show up in some way in some of the rankings or other variables that we're rated upon is not a bad thing. And I think when we really get people thinking about it, we're going to have the kind of diversity that we need to address this problem on a national scale.
Great. Cappy Hill and Bernie Matchin, thank you very much for joining us for this conversation about the New York Times ranking scheme. Our second segment today focuses on triage in retention efforts. New research from the Education Advisory Board states what many have suspected or known. Some potential at-risk students are more at-risk than others, and not all retention interventions are equally rewarded. What's intriguing about the board's report is the explicit suggestion that institutions should consider an ROI, a return on investment-based triage model that targets retention efforts on the potentially at-risk students who are better prospects to stay enrolled in college than their peers. The target group identified for a higher ROI retention intervention by the board's research consists of students who complete their freshman year with GPAs that range from 2.0 to 3.0. characterized by the board as, quote, the murky middle, compared to their peers with GPAs over 3.0, who are most likely to earn degrees, and those with GPAs under 2.0, who will most likely drop out of college. Joining us for the conversation are Ed Venet, Senior Director at the Education Advisory Board, and Scott Jasek, co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. So, Ed Venet, let me turn to you. This suggestion about an ROI-based retention initiative or interventions is not without controversy, and rather than try to explain it, perhaps let me give you the first opportunity to do so.
Sure. Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here today. It's actually a relatively simple concept. When we look at what universities are doing right now to intervene with students who they think may not graduate, we see a lot of programs focused on the first year, and that's a good strategy. The biggest single year for loss is the first year. But about 50 to 60% of students who leave school are going to leave after the first year. And largely, these students are overlooked. There's not a whole lot of attention devoted to them. They don't seem to be, for lack of a better term, on fire. They don't have a straight F GPA. They're not obviously struggling. And yet, they're still not going to make it through college. So what we're trying to do is sort of open up institutions' attention to this population of students, which, like I said, they haven't done much with thus far. And help them realize, actually, there's an opportunity here to help these students as well. And, in fact, they may be easier to get all the way to graduation for a couple different reasons.
So let me be clear in terms of what you're saying. It's not that you're suggesting that institutions should abandon or reduce first-year efforts, but rather you're saying that after the first year, some of these efforts might be targeted in somewhat different ways. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. We're not at all saying that you should stop doing what you're doing the first year. We think that those strategies are essential. There's been decades of research that goes into helping first-year students make it into the second year. The issue here is not with those practices at all. It's with the relative lack of attention that's paid after that to helping those students that are saved into the second year make it all the way through into graduation.
Scott Jasek, this suggestion, when the article was published by Inside Higher Ed about the murky middle strategy, it was not without controversy. Can you talk about some of the controversy in the comments that it received?
Sure. I mean, it got a very large audience. Lots of people were really interested in this research. And I think the concerns people had were whether colleges might become too Darwinian and sort of ignore those who might be at greater disadvantage. At the same time, other colleges are very concerned about getting grad rates up, and they want to know the ROI. So it's not like anybody is against helping any one group, but the reality is that many colleges, it's a zero-sum game. They have a finite amount of money and time to spend on these efforts.
Ed, as I read the Inside Higher Ed article and as I read the report and the material on your website, what struck me is you talked about a population of students, but there wasn't much about interventions or which interventions might be more successful. Can you backfill some of that in terms of what interventions for second-year students might seem be more effective than others?
Sure, and just to clarify, we're not just talking about the second year, but actually second, third, and fourth year. Where we see these students leaving school. In fact, it's a surprising number of students leave very close to graduation. But the real challenge with the murky middle is in spotting those who are headed for dropout versus those who are heading for graduation. If you look at this population of students, they kind of look identical to each other. And we think actually one of the reasons schools haven't spent so much time, so much attention on this population is it's very difficult to spot which student is headed in the right direction, which student's headed in you know, the other way. So what we're doing here is conducting some additional research to really pinpoint who will become an eventual dropout so that we can go and hopefully turn their case around. One thing that we're seeing is a very clear pattern. Of those students in the middle, that sort of 2 to 3 GPA, those who have term-by-term GPAs that increase are going to go graduate. In fact, graduates have increasing GPAs each term. If you see students with decreasing GPAs each term, term-by-term GPA, those students are headed for dropout. So it's actually easier to precisely target who needs some help out of that group. And then you meet with those students and sort of figure out, okay, well, what's going wrong here? It may be something to do with the coursework. It may be something outside of class entirely. Regardless, it requires a human touch to actually sit down with those students and figure out, what can we do to help you? Because likely those students aren't coming forward to ask for help in the first place.
So it sounds like what you're proposing is, in one sense, some kind of analytic tool that looks for the patterns in those student transcripts, followed up with a personal touch. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. And we work with over 100 schools in a group we call the Student Success Collaborative. And it's precisely that. We're working on helping develop an analytics platform such that they can target those students and really go after them to help hopefully turn them around and get them all the way through to graduation.
Scott, institutions have been looking at retention as an enrollment strategy since the enrollment downturn of the early 1980s. And it ebbs and flows depending on the economy and enrollments. Is there something new in the suggestions that we're hearing about targeting the murky middle?
Well, there hasn't actually been much attention to the murky middle. I think what's new is a much greater interest in retention. Part of it is scrutiny from accreditors, state, federal governments wanting to know that people stay. Part of it is practical. It is less expensive to retain a student than to recruit a student. And part of it is growing awareness of how many students start higher ed and don't finish. National Student Clearinghouse just came out with a report that 31 million people in the last two decades were enrolled and left without a degree or certificate. And thinking about the murky middle, they said that 4 million of those moved past the two-year mark. So there are clearly a lot of students who are almost there and not making it. And that's why I think there was so much interest in this research.
And I want to come to the flip side of the murky middle suggestion. Again, going back to the materials on your website, the board states that perhaps just 15% of students with a GPA of 2.0 or under will make it to graduation. If that's the case, and while that number may vary from campus to campus, and as analytics get better at predicting these things, you know, the obvious question is, does prediction become destiny? And if that's the case, and given rising student debt, whether it's public or private nonprofit institutions, for that second-year student who has a GPA that's hovering around 2.0, 2.1, 2.2, where there is not that upward slope that you alluded to earlier, is there an institutional obligation to be candid about prospects for success?
Yeah, so it's really interesting to look at this. The first thing we see is that, frankly, there aren't too many students who make it into the second year below a 2.0 GPA. Most simply won't come back. And there's a variety of reasons why that might happen, anything from, you know, this wasn't the right thing for them to do, or maybe they're not ready for college quite yet. So the tough conversations you're proposing, there just wouldn't be a large population of students to even have those with. That being said, the broader question about whether or not schools need to be honest with students, if they know data that is about, well, you have a very low likelihood of succeeding in, let's say, this major that you've chosen. We do believe that there's an obligation for schools to use that information to help those students find a better path to graduation. Not necessarily saying, hey, college isn't right for you, but rather the way that you're pursuing it You don't know it, but we know it. It has a low likelihood of success. How can we help you succeed moving forward if nothing changes? And a really important thing to highlight here is that we do not believe predictions are destiny. We tell every one of our schools that we work with that what you're really trying to do is change the destiny of this student. That's why we're making the prediction in the first place. If nothing else changed, if you were going current course and speed, this wouldn't be good. But we obviously do want to change that.
Scott, is that a realistic assessment that institutions will be candid with students that way in those one-on-one sessions?
Well, I mean, the problem with any analytic tool is you can design a great analytic tool, but then it's execution in terms of academic advising. So could they do exactly what Ed says? Yes, they could. Are all institutions investing in academic advising that way? I'm not sure we're there yet. So it's not necessarily, though, the fault of a tool if institutions aren't using it to its full capacity.
Well, let's come back to the tool issue. Ed, again, you know, the analytics can pinpoint those students and do a better job of pinpointing the students, but at least your comments earlier suggested this is still a high-touch intervention. And for many institutions, that high-touch intervention requires both a willing student and an able counselor. How much of a change is that in terms of both institutional policy and institutional obligation?
Yeah, that's a great question. The thing that hasn't changed here is advisors' desire to help students. It's why they got into the profession in the first place. You speak with these folks, and they're less interested in the macro, the abstract graduation rate, and more interested in helping the student that's sitting right across from them get through the challenge that they have, or help them guide, or help guide them to graduation, or help them find their career or the right major. The change for them, though, is helping them understand you've been flying kind of blind in the past. You haven't had objective historical data to work with. What if you did? How would you integrate that into the workflow that you had with this student? How would you use that information, leverage it in that conversation to better help that student move forward? Because now you have more information than you ever had available before. The challenge for them is, well, this is a paradigm shift for them. They are not used to doing it this way. And it does take some time. The schools that we're working with, it's a slow cultural change, but it is happening. And once advisors get it, they really get it. They understand the power of what they have for having data for a tough conversation with a student. Or if a student wants to know all their options, well, which one of these majors might be the best fit for me? Which one might I be the most likely to succeed? And laying it all out, students really appreciate that. So they're beginning to see, okay, now I kind of get it. Now I understand why this is a tool that I can use. And again, we come back to, you know, this isn't trying to mechanize advising. We are giving you a tool that you can use. The tool doesn't use you. And that message really resonates with them.
Scott, Ed's comments would seem to put a huge burden on academic advisors. And depending on the institution, the people who are academic advisors are all over the map. In some cases, they are faculty. In some cases, they are graduate assistants. In some cases, they are a professional cadre of academic advisors who don't have faculty status but specialize in different majors. Is it realistic to put academic advisors in that pivot point, that first line, and expect that they're going to be able to do the kind of intervention and perhaps in some sense magic that Ed's suggesting?
I think it's realistic if they have appropriate time and support. You need to look at questions like how many advisees per academic advisor, and that's obviously going to differ if it's a full-time faculty member or a professional advisor. But to really look at the data and to come up with a good course for a student or a bunch of options for a student, that's money. And I think the issue we've reported on during the economic downturn starting in 2008, a lot of colleges cut academic advising. And so it's the academic advisors, Ed is absolutely right, they want to do well by their students. They do need a certain level of support, I think, to do well.
Great. Ed and Scott, thank you very much for the conversation to clarify the efforts to target the murky middle in retention efforts. Thank you for joining us this week, and our thanks to the individuals who aided and informed our conversations. Cappy Hill, the president of Vassar College, Bernie Matchin, the president of the University of Florida, Ed Venet, senior director at the Education Advisory Board, and of course Scott Jasek, co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio streamer podcast early afternoons on most Fridays. On the web, we are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. Please share your thoughts about This Week with us on the comments section of the webpage. Thank you.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.